I want to begin with a prophecy, and it's a very unusual prophecy because it's one that you can prove empirically. I want to start back in the year 1640, which was one of the worst years in the history of Europe prior to 1940. It was an era when Catholics were killing Protestants, Protestants were killing Catholics, Christians were killing Jews. Everyone was killing people that they believed to be witches. And things were so bad that many people wondered that Christianity itself could not survive. Maybe European civilization could not survive. And it was at that time that a man called St. Vincent de Paul, great Catholic saint, made an interesting observation that was a prophecy. He said, Jesus said, his church would last till the end of time. He never mentioned the word Europe. The church of the church of the future, he said in 1640, will be the church of South America, the church of Africa, the church of China, and the church of Japan. And I suggest to you that that's not only a wise remark and an intelligent remark, it is actively a prophetic remark, because it has largely come true in our lifetimes. We can argue about Japan, although Japan in the 20th century did produce arguably the greatest Christian novelist of the century, Shusaku Endo. But otherwise, if you look at that geography, that is a very accurate description of the centers of Christianity in coming decades. So St. Vincent de Paul is not quite fulfilled in his remark, but give him until about 2040 and he will be. Presently, there are about 2.2 billion Christians in the world. The largest contingent of those are still in Europe, followed by those in Latin America and more distantly, Africa. As you move forward over the next 20 or 30 years, that picture will change quite rapidly and will move ever further southward into Latin America, into Africa and Asia. But as you move towards 2050, there's no doubt Africa wins. And I want to do a couple of things here. First of all, I want to use some numbers. And it's very easy to hit people over the head with numbers. But some of them just demand to be heard. Now, I realize that my title today is Reading the Bible in the Global South. But what I'm talking about at the moment is the so what? What does it matter how people read the Bible, the different ways they read the Bible in Africa, say. Here's why. Here's why. First of all, look at some figures. Nothing to do with religion. Look at what happened to the population of Africa over the last century or so. The population of the continent of Africa back in 1900 was about 100 million. In 2005, it topped 1 billion. By 2050, it will be approximately 2.2 billion. In 1900, there were four Europeans for every African. By 2050, there will be three Africans for every European. Regardless of what you think about what happens in terms of religion, that is a dramatic, massive change. And it's even more specific. You look at particular areas. You look at an area of East Africa, for instance, covered by the countries of Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania. Back in 1900, those three countries, which have a land area about the size of Western Europe, had maybe 7 or 8 million people in that vast area. Today, the figure is probably around 100 million, and by 2050, it should be about a quarter of a billion. Now, I'm not just mentioning this story out of a, you know, believe it or not, USA amazing population statistics, because this does have a huge impact on religion. Back in 1900, a tiny proportion of Africa's people were Christian. During the 20th century, that proportion grew enormously, so that in 1900, there were about 10 million Christians in the whole of Africa. By 2000, there were 360 million Christians in Africa. And almost certainly by 2050, there will be about 1 billion Christians in Africa. By that point, by 2050, Africa will have by far the world's largest Christian population. It will have several of the largest Christian populations in the world. And if you want to think of what a typical Christian looks like and what the opinion of a typical Christian might be, look at Africa. Even today, if you want to think of a typical Christian, you know, think of a woman living in a village in Nigeria or a favela in Brazil, and that is going to be even more true as the century goes on. Christianity, in a good way, is going south. In terms of the countries in the world with the largest Christian populations, here's a map of the Christian world in 2050. I don't swear to these figures, but it's a good working estimate. Where will the largest numbers of Christians be? The largest country should still be the United States, followed in no particular order by Brazil, Mexico, Nigeria, the Congo, Ethiopia, the Philippines, and probably China. What are the countries I did not mention in that list? Britain, France, Spain. If you look at particular churches, they are experiencing this globalization, this southernization, if you like, at an even more acute and rapid level. The Roman Catholic Church, the world's largest Christian body, is the classic example. During the 20th century, the growth rate of Christianity, Catholic Christianity in Africa between 1900 and 2000 was 6,700%. As I tell people, you know, if you have a humanities background, that's more than double. That's a very significant increase. Last year, there were more Catholic baptisms in the Philippines than in France, Spain, Italy, and Poland combined. If you want to think of a typical Catholic, think south. I always use a quote from somebody we don't normally think of in terms of theology, who is John Updike, and he's a rather nice quote, which is, God doesn't like Sweden. He doesn't play well in Sweden. God sticks pretty close to the equator. And that's a pretty fair description of what we're doing. Well, if this was just a story of geography, if it was just a story of ethnicity, then it would be an interesting series of factoids. It would mean that Christianity was shifting to become a black and brown religion. However, something far more significant is happening in the course of that change. As it is moving south, Christianity is changing its character, or, if you like, changing back to a much older character. And we see that, for example, in some of the global splits that have emerged. I mean, most celebrated in something like the Anglican Communion, which is the U.S. branch of which is the Episcopal Church. You know, the Episcopal Church tries to adopt very liberal policies on sexuality. It ordains openly gay and lesbian bishops, and there is a scream of outrage from the global south. And the first response is, who are you to complain about this? And then the good people of Nigeria and Uganda and Kenya say, this is who we are to complain about this. We are the Church of Nigeria. There were 5 million of us in 1975. There are about 25 million of us today. There will be 35 million in 2025. How are you doing? And the question then is, it appears that we have a north-south divide in matters of authority, and specifically of biblical authority. Why does this happen? There's a story I always enjoy. A few years ago at one of these Anglican events, there was a Bible study featuring an African Anglican bishop, and an American Episcopal bishop, and both were very honest, very intelligent, but they were just approaching the text in totally different ways. And the Episcopalian, the American Episcopalian, read the text in this very critical, very nuanced way, and the African was much more traditional, literal-minded, and became ever more frustrated until he said, if you don't believe the Bible, why did you bring it to us in the first place? And that's sort of a question which features in many denominations. I'm talking about the Anglicans, but Methodists and Lutherans and Presbyterians are all looking nervously over the parapet at this struggle and wondering how and when it is going to affect them. I suggest that a lot of the difference in authority reflects the way in which the Bible is often read in many Global South churches. Now, please understand what I'm saying here. I'm not for a second suggesting that there is such a thing as Western Christianity. As we all know, it includes many, many different shades and nuances. There is no such thing as Southern Christianity or African Christianity. There are a billion people in Africa, probably 480 million Christians, many, many different traditions, many different readings. However, they do have certain things in common. Many of them, most of them, are first or second generation Christian. They are reading the Bible in a fresh way. They are coming to it with a different set of cultural expectations that affects readings. And one result of that is when they read the Bible, they find that it makes sense to them in ways that it does not and perhaps cannot for people in, or many people in, the United States. When you do that, when you read the Bible and it's, but this is my life, then you tend to believe the moral authority, the teaching authority of the Bible, because it is so obviously describing your world. You know, in debates over, for example, homosexuality in the United States, one person might cite Leviticus, and a more liberal person might say, but Leviticus was written for a totally different world. It has no authority for us. It's not relevant. It's written for this ancient society. Leviticus says homosexuality is wrong. It also says you can own people from neighboring countries. What, can I really own a Canadian? And probably not. Now imagine reading the Old Testament in a church that is coming to the Bible for the first time, and that is reading it in a way which recognizes the society of the Old Testament as its own. If you ever want to read one of the great books about African Christianity, or indeed about Africa, it was written as long ago as 1936 by a man called Akiki Niabongo. And he was an African prince, a prince of the Toro people. And he wrote this book about the conversion of his people. And he has a wonderful moment there with this very, what shall I say, very dry Western missionary comes along and tries to convert the people and give certain rules, high on the list of which is no polygamy. And then, as often happens, it's the young people who start figuring out the Bible. And when they've stopped looking for the dirty bits, they then start looking for other interesting angles. And there is the pupil who is called Mujungu, who is actually Mr. Niabongo himself, discovers a passage and goes to the people with triumph. And soon, as he says, wherever two people gathered in the village, they would discuss this passage. And the next time the missionary showed up, the chief was waiting for him. You lied to me. You said polygamy was wrong. But there is a man called Solomon, and he had 1,000 wives and concubines and loved them all equally, it says. Does this mean you are too poor to buy more wives for yourself, and you tried to impose this on us? And the missionary tries explaining, well, you must realize, Solomon was not a Christian. He lived before the time of the New Testament. But you told me all parts of this book carried authority. I suggest to you that in the United States, a very common problem for Christians is trying to get people to treat the Old Testament seriously. In Africa, the problem is trying to get people to treat the Old Testament less seriously than the New. The Old Testament speaks so powerfully in terms of a recognizable society to many Africans, of course it carries weight. A great many Africans, of course, live in cities. We today live in the greatest age of urbanization in human history, and it's happening in Africa. Most Africans do not know personally about concepts like nomadism, blood sacrifice, paganism, polygamy, but their parents did, and people who live down the road do. When they read the Old Testament, they are reading a picture of a world that they know. Let me give you an example. For many Americans, for many Westerners, there are parts of the Old Testament that are off-putting and disturbing, which affect, for example, the universality of sacrifice. There is this idea of sin being a communal thing, sin being something that can taint a nation. The whole community, the whole nation has to purge that sin in terms of fasting, in terms of sacrifice. These are strange, alien ideas. For most Africans, these are very, very familiar ideas. You don't have to say, we have this strange idea called sacrifice, called atonement. The comment is rather, well, of course you have to atone for sins with blood. Any fool knows that. But what you're telling me is that Jesus is this one and once and for all sacrifice. Now that's a remarkable idea. If you take one of the great modern African theologians who tragically died a couple of years ago, called Kwame Bediako, he did this wonderful commentary on the epistles of Paul. And he singled out one epistle, Pauline or otherwise, which was Hebrews, and made an interesting comment, which was, for Africans, this is the most important epistle. This is, in fact, Africa's epistle. Why is that? What is Hebrews about? It describes a world where the temple is still a current reality, where the priest still carries out sacrifices and explains that Jesus is the sacrifice that ends all sacrifices. For most modern Westerners, you can read this with a commentary and just about understand the ideas. In West Africa, in a country like Ghana, where the year revolves around the sacrifices called the Odwiras, a Christian can explain Jesus Christ is the Odwira that ends all Odwiras. This is a very powerful idea. Whenever I meet an evangelical in this country who talks about the blood of the lamb, I always have a question for him. Have you ever seen a lamb sacrificed? Have you ever seen the blood of the lamb? Probably not. I then sometimes ask them if they know how the harvest was last year before they talk about harvests, and usually not. Protestants deceive themselves. Protestants claim to be the people of the Bible. That's not true. They're the people of the Bible and hymn book. And that is perhaps true of no one more than Baptists. If you want to understand the religion of a Christian society, look at their hymns. We today live in the greatest ever age of Christian hymn writing, greater than the age of Wesley and Whitfield. Unfortunately, most of them are in languages that the majority of us can't understand. They're in Yoruba, they're in Swahili, they are in Tamil. Not long ago, an Anglican scholar embarked on a project to collect all the hymns of the Dinka people in the Sudan. And what he wanted to do was to take all these hymns which circulated orally and were not written down, and to transcribe them. And the bishop of the Dinka people said, oh, this is a wonderful idea. To my knowledge, we have at least 16,000 waiting to be transcribed. If you look at the hymns, the ideas that I am talking about emerge so strongly. The greatest East African hymn is the Tuku Tendereza Jesu. For 100 years, it's been the centerpiece of East African Christianity. It's the hymn of revival. Trying to understand East African Christianity without the hymns is like trying to understand Protestantism without Amazing Grace. It's hard. What is it about? It's about being washed in the blood of the Lamb. It's about the blood. It's about the Lamb. The centrality of that kind of concept also affects the kind of books that resonate, the way that people read books. Again, there's a Tanzanian theologian called Fidon Mwambeki, and he comments about reading the book of Revelation, and he has to keep turning back to make sure that this was not written in modern Africa, because every part of it reflects basically African spiritual ideas. The idea that the dead are alive and affect the life of the of living people. The idea that innocent blood has been shed and cries out. The images, the blood, the lamb, the throne, all these African ideas. And he says it's amazing, and many other African theologians make this point, so much of the Bible, from their point of view, reads African. And there are a fair number of theorists who will say, well, this must mean that many of those ancient Hebrews must have brought their ideas into Africa, because when we read Genesis, we understand it. Think then, when somebody quotes a moral instruction from Leviticus, say, very widely, in Africa, people will then say, well, yes, that is a book that speaks to us. That is a relevant book to us. Therefore, the moral authority, the religious authority, must also carry weight. And this ranges across a remarkably broad spectrum of opinion. There's a South African theologian I like to quote called Madipoane Masenya, who is a liberal, a feminist, and she has a remark I like, which is, if any African finds it hard to identify with the Old Testament, they really need to take a good look at themselves and figure out if they might not have lost their Africanness in some way. Could a European say an equivalent remark? Could an American say an equivalent remark? Well, maybe not. By the way, I've talked about a couple of books which resonate very much in Africa especially, and there's a very simple guide you can use which I pass on to you as a means of detecting which books are going to work in Africa. You look at what Martin Luther said about it. If Martin Luther hated it, it goes down great in Africa. And that's a very simple principle. He did not like Hebrews, he did not like Revelation, and he had a couple of other pet hates, which I'll be referring to in a moment. I call this the Luther gold standard. It works splendidly. I don't want to suggest that the Christianity that is booming in global South nations, in Asia and Africa especially, is necessarily a religion of the poor. It is not. Many of the most successful churches are found in upwardly mobile communities, particularly in the Pacific Rim. In some countries like China, Christianity is associated with modernization, sometimes westernization, which can be a problematic idea. But for many Christians around the world, poverty is a pressing reality. If you look at the world's billion poorest people, those living on $2 a day or less, the largest single religious contingent in that group is Christians. Think about reading the Bible, not just with agricultural eyes, but with poor eyes. Think about reading the parables, for example, when you know very well that a poor woman who loses a coin is going to root out the whole house trying to find it, or her children don't eat that night. They know perfectly well that there are roads that travelers dare not walk down, or else they will be beaten and left for dead, and perhaps they will be lucky and a good Samaritan will find them. This whole idea was brought home to me in an interesting way. I was talking to some West Africans once upon a time, and I was asking them about what are some of the Bible passages which really rang true for them, and you know, some of the ones were fairly obvious. And with some emotion, my friend said, "Oh, and then of course there's Psalm 126. You know, the sorting machine goes very slowly. You can hear the squirrel wheels turning. Okay. And Psalm 126 includes a passage which runs roughly as follows. The farmer who sows his seed weeping will bring the sheaves again, rejoicing at the harvest." Now, that's used as a resurrection passage. It's used by St. Paul. It's used especially in funeral services. And it's easy to see why somebody would rejoice at the harvest, rejoice when the sheaves are brought in. Here's a question for you. Why is the farmer weeping as he sows the seed? And my friend said, "Oh, it's obvious," a remark I hate. And finally, they explained it to me. Well, it's obvious. At the time this psalm was composed, there was obviously a famine in the land, just like we have. You have a certain amount of corn, and you have a choice. You can eat it now if you want, and feed your family, and feed your kids, and everyone will be fine just now. But you've got nothing to plant for next year. And if you do that, that means that you're going to have to give up your farm. Next year, to avoid starvation, you're going to have to leave everything, sell your land if you can get anything for it, and move to the city. And your children are going to be begging. Or you can take the seed literally out of the mouths of your starving children, and you can go plant it. And when you go off to the fields, you're weeping. It's obvious. And by the way, that is a that connection. It's observed by travelers, particularly in the Holy Land, all through the 19th century. You see people going off to sow weeping. I don't know. Was it obvious to you? It was not obvious to me. So perhaps people see things somewhat differently. When you read the Bible through poor eyes, when you read the Bible through hungry eyes, you begin to see, for example, how much of the Bible is about food. And that may seem obvious. You know, what are the stories about food in the Western press? Well, I think we have an alleged obesity epidemic. There's the odd product scare about particularly kinds of food. In many other parts of the world, however, you know, famine is still a very real threat. I heard a figure today that in Somalia now holds the record for the proportion of children who are in acute danger of death from starvation, and that's running at 20%. How much of the Bible and the imagery of the Bible is about food in ways that can't speak to us? When you want to imagine the day of the Lord, what will it be like? It'll be like an amazing banquet where everyone has enough to eat. Can you imagine such a thing? And where the rich will be sent empty away. Now that's a powerful image. Imagine reading the Bible in a society where people not only don't have enough to eat, but don't expect to live anything like as long as we generally do. Imagine, for instance, that you read some of the passages in the Bible about, death will soon be upon you and your life is short. And we read it and we nod. Most of us don't believe it. Most of us believe we're going to be partying like it's 2099. Now imagine reading a passage like that in a society where the average age in a congregation is going to be 21 or 22, where the pastor is going to be an old gray beard of 29 or 30, and where it's quite possible that the average age of death is going to be 38. As I've worked on this topic, I've not only come across particular books that I've read again with new eyes. Ruth is one example. Ruth is a story which goes down wonderfully in Africa. Why is that? I can't imagine a story of a society devastated by famine, which is held together by people holding true to kin obligations. That has a whole relevance. I've not only rediscovered, if you like, whole books, but whole types of literature, whole genres. And one of the ones I've found most striking is that of wisdom literature, which accounts for a large part of the Bible. We live in a society that values creativity, innovation, saying something for the first time. We don't value proverbs. We don't value traditional wisdom. Okay, in modern history, who is the fictional pop culture character who is most famously associated with proverbs? Forrest Gump, correct. Now imagine a society where proverbs are literally the voice of wisdom, where they represent the voice of the ancestors from whom there is no appeal. And then you discover the Bible, which is loaded with this material. There's an African theologian called Mercy Oduyoye who talks about growing up in a Christian girls' school where every day the girls would have to recite a piece of scripture. And what most of them would do is they take one of their traditional proverbs in the Akan language, they turn it into King James English and see if they could get away with it. And Mercy Oduyoye figures that they had about an 80% success rate. Proverbs speak in ways that perhaps they don't in the West, as do certain books. The Epistle of James, I always find a classic example. Did I mention that Martin Luther did not think James should be in the New Testament? Here's a challenge for you. If you had to pick a piece of scripture which you could use to present to people from other religions as representing the best face of Christianity, the best face of the Bible, what would you choose? And some people might choose the Beatitudes. Some people might choose part of very mystical passages from the Gospel of John. I have a candidate. Sections of the Epistle of James. Why? Because it's written for a poor world. It's written for a world where people expect not to live very long, and they know that they must condition their life in the meantime by that fact. There's one passage I cite to you, which is in James chapter 4, and I paraphrase. You say that tomorrow you'll go to this city, you'll go do this business. You fool. You don't know what's going to happen to you tomorrow. Your life is a mist. Your life is a vapor. It rises and vanishes away. What you should say is, if God wills, I will do this. If there is a passage which crosses religions, that works wonderfully. Christians use James to try and convert Muslims. Muslims use James to try and convert Christians. Buddhists love James. A few years ago, there was an English publishing venture called Revelations, which took books of the Bible and introduced them, had introductions by distinguished spiritual leaders like Bono. Guess who got to introduce the Epistle of James? The Dalai Lama. And the Dalai Lama began by saying, roughly, I know very little of Christianity. I do know a lot about Buddhism. This is wonderful Buddhism. And he particularly focused on that particular passage and said, oh, yes, if there is a passage which epitomizes Buddhism, this is it. In fact, he said, you call this wisdom literature. We have a name in Tibet for this kind of literature. It's Lojong, mind training. Know that you are going to die and live accordingly. So what I'm suggesting is that if you actually read the Bible with Global South eyes, not only do you discover some interesting different books, but you discover whole genres that perhaps do not have the same kind of power. When I did my book New Faces of Christianity a few years ago, I actually included the Epistle of James as a as an appendix, and you read it. And it sends one message, which is always worth remembering in America or Europe. So many of what we regard as natural, normal divisions do not apply. If you want to go to a Global South church, there are certain things that you have to remember. One is, take everything you know about different factions, different sides, evangelical, charismatic, Catholic, forget them. Are you evangelical? Are you Catholic? Or are you charismatic? Yes, indeed I am. Do you speak for liberation theology? Very active. You want to, as James says, go now, you rich men, weep and howl for the suffering that will come upon you. Or do you represent a charismatic deliverance kind of Christianity? For most African churches, liberation and deliverance, as for James, are one. If you don't teach both, you are offering an impaired message. And the other thing that you have to take very seriously, and perhaps you will rediscover, is the absolute centrality of healing in the Christian message. In the churches that are growing fastest around the world and which are going to be the largest proportion of that African billion. And I mean healing in a very broad sense. I mean healing of body, healing of mind, healing of spirit, healing of society. But if you take healing out of the picture, you lose so much. And there are any number of stories about this. You know, one of the easiest things in the world is to talk about churches that are growing very fast. And not long ago, the president of Uganda was asked if a particular church was doing well in his country. And he looked with contempt and said, it's a religion. Of course it's doing well. And some of the churches that are doing well do so in a very strange guise. In Tanzania, for example, one of the most potent, most respected religious leaders is a prophet, and above all, a charismatic healer and a Lutheran bishop. You know, we are several thousand miles from Lake Wobegon. The fastest growing Mennonite church is that in Ethiopia, which of course practices healing and exorcism. How could it not? If you are not prepared to take those concepts seriously, you will find it very, very hard to speak to most the major Global South churches. In fact, there's put this together. There's a story I always enjoy. I want you to imagine a scene in a church where there has just been a very special service. And during the course of the service, a woman wishes to announce that she's been healed of a spinal complaint that has bothered her many years. So she gives testimony. Then a man next to her gives testimony about his healing, and somebody else gives testimony about her healing, and we work round. And finally, the deacon in the church begins looking at his watch and wants to get out of there by next Sunday. And so he says, all right, no more individual testimonies. I'm sure you've seen this in your churches. Anyone who has been healed of this kind of disease, raise your hands now. 24, 25, okay, hands down. What sort of church was this? Of course, it's a Roman Catholic church, and the miracle occurs during the exposition of the Blessed Sacrament, a very conservative kind of ritual. Then you read things like that, and you realize that the division between evangelical churches, Catholic churches and the charismatic is slim to non-existent. And that if you do not take those charismatic healing elements very seriously, you're missing a great deal about those churches and the way they read the Bible, the passages they read in the Bible. People who spend their lives ransacking the Bible for any reference to a word like loosing, untying. I quote one Zimbabwean sermon where a woman is saying, Jesus said, untie that donkey. Women of Zimbabwe, we are that donkey. It is our time to be untied. Stand by to have all your concepts, all your traditional divisions trampled. There's a man called Titus Pressler who wrote about Zimbabwe, who includes this sort of jaw-dropping sentence, and he's talking about the impact of religious change in Zimbabwe, and he sees three main consequences. What are the consequences of the religious revival? Charismatic renewal, conflict with demons, and the liberation of women. When did you last see those two used in the same sentence? Not frequently. So what I'm suggesting is this. When you read the Bible with, let's look at it in terms of African eyes, so much of it makes sense as a portrait of the world you know. You know that when you go to the market, there will be a woman there with a familiar spirit. You know that there will be a magician. You know that there will be demons to be cast out. You know there will be exorcisms. Jim Wallace, a left liberal theologian in this country, points out that if you take passages about the poor out of the Bible, you don't have much left. He's absolutely right. If you take passages about angels, demons, healings, and exorcisms out, you're left with a very thin pamphlet indeed. Read the Bible with Global South eyes, and you come across a lot of surprising readings. What's the best known Psalm, the 23rd Psalm, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. What's it about? What is that Psalm about? Well, obviously, it's yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. So obviously, it's a funeral. It's a death Psalm. It's used at funerals. In Great Britain and the Commonwealth, it's used at weddings. Don't ask. Africans know what it is. It's a political psalm. It's about challenging tyranny because they live in a society where every tyrant, every general, every Robert Mugabe claims to be the generous shepherd taking care of his people. And they have a simple response. Uh-uh. The Lord is my shepherd. You're not. Did I mention it's also used for exorcisms? So what I'm suggesting is it is possible to read the Bible in these very different ways. I'm not suggesting that, you know, contemporary African churches have got this mystical link with the era of the New Testament. Absolutely not. Often their readings, you know, historically are as far removed as anyone else's. But imagine being able to read the Bible with that documentary present relevance as describing your society. And what that then does to give authority to the words, the instructions of the text. And at that point, the Bible becomes not just a source of authority, but a quite revolutionary manual. Changing social structures, changing family structures. And as we said earlier, the conflict with demons and the liberation of women. So I would argue that what you are looking at in the present stage of Bible reading in the Global South, this generation or two in, is very much a rerun of what Europe saw in the Reformation and that far-reaching reconstruction. Well, I have learned many things from Baptist scholars and teachers through the years, but I learned a very fine lesson from a Baptist preacher once upon a time, which was the three golden rules of preaching, which is stand up to be seen, speak up to be heard, sit down to be appreciated. And I'll now follow that third injunction. Thank you very much.